From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, broadcasting today from NHPR in Concord, New Hampshire, ahead of tomorrow's primaries. And if you don't yet know how to pronounce candidates' name, say Buttigieg, just go outside.
Buttigieg! Buttigieg! Buttigieg!
It's cold, but I'm feeling the burn.
I said
it's cold, but I'm feeling the burn.
My name's DJ, and I just think Elizabeth Warren's great. I really appreciate her, ideas on big structural change and getting rid of corruption.
Let's go, go! Let's go, go! Let's go, go!
Sounds from supporters of Biden, Warren, Sanders, and Buttigieg. Uncertainty looms is the headline on the Concord Monitor today, referring to the many voters still undecided. And in this state, independents can vote in this Democratic primary. They make up 42% of the electorate. Iowa is somewhat in the rearview mirror here. We sat down with Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen and asked about other concerns. What about the other criticism of both Iowa and New Hampshire? The population voting in these two first-in-the-nation states is not diverse enough, for instance.
Well, New Hampshire is not about having the most diverse population. You know, I think the nominating process added Nevada and South Carolina in a way to ensure that diversity is reflected. What's important in New Hampshire is that we have a very engaged electorate. We have one of the highest voter turnouts of any state in the country, and we need to be able to have a place where you can come if you don't have the most money and name recognition and be able to talk to voters about your vision for the country and where we need to take America.
What about this year in particular? And the primary coming off a pretty volatile week. We had the end of the impeachment trial. We had a State of the Union in which we saw Republican lawmakers, as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, chanting 4 more years. We've been saying divided electorate for so long. Do you think we're in a more dangerous place now?
Well, it was disappointing to me to see that the president didn't take the opportunity that, with the impeachment over, to reach across the aisle.
Was Speaker Pelosi wrong in tearing up his speech?
I didn't think it was appropriate when the president refused to shake the speaker's hand, and I don't think it's appropriate for her to have torn up the speech.
Going into the primary, what are you hearing from voters? What are their biggest concerns?
Health care. You know, whether it's the high cost of prescription drugs. We have a number of different plans on the Democratic side among our candidates who all are talking about one of the things that would most lower prescription drug costs is if we allow the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare to actually negotiate with the drug companies. And the Republicans and the president have refused to acknowledge that that would lower costs.
Well, and I know that you are not endorsing a candidate, but can you weigh in on kind of the tug of war over the party right now between the progressives who want to eventually get rid of private insurance and those who say that's just too fast, too much?
You know, I've been involved in Democratic politics for a long time. I remember the fight between the liberal wing and the moderate wing when I was working for Jimmy Carter. So this is not unusual and not surprising. And I think the important thing is that every Democratic candidate is talking about expanding health care to all Americans.
I have to mention your race, and we should mention your challengers, retired Brigadier General Donald Bolduc, former New Hampshire House Speaker Bill O'Brien, attorney Bryant Messner. What are you telling voters? Why should they pick you?
I think we've got a big difference between where I stand on issues like health care, lowering prescription drug costs, as I've said, and where my opponents stand. They all want to overturn the Affordable Care Act. My opponents all stand with President Trump on issues like the tariffs. Now, the president signed the United States-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which I support, and we need to be able to work together to address the challenges that we face.
You know, we just met two of your constituents who are a married couple. Their company is Alliant Metals in Hampstead. They depend upon imported steel. And even though they're being hurt right now by the tariffs, they say it's worth sticking with it because they believe in the long term it'll help bring back manufacturing. What do you say to them?
No, I think trying to address China's bad behavior is very important. I think there are other ways that we could be doing it that have less of an impact on businesses like Alliant.
And as we look ahead to primary day tomorrow, I'm sure that the state is being more vigilant than ever because we remember the last election, there were falsehoods spread that busloads of Massachusetts people had been brought in to vote.
Well, sadly, that was part of the disinformation campaign, the foreign interference in our elections in 2016. I think we all need to be vigilant about foreign interference.
And just to underscore, that was not true. That did not happen. The busloads.
That did not happen. You know, we're also hearing that there were phones jammed in Iowa, as my campaign was a victim of a phone jamming scheme by the Republican Party in 2002. I hope that what goes on here is not the Republican Party trying to interfere with the election. We've been doing the New Hampshire primary for about 100 years now. I have every expectation and belief that people will be enthusiastic and that it will go very well.
It also is people are looking to New Hampshire to see, you know, how's the party feeling after a failed attempt at an impeachment trial and a conviction? Then there's Iowa. What's the health of the Democratic Party right now?
You know, the projection from the Secretary of State in New Hampshire is that we were going to have a record turnout here, even higher than 2016 when we had primary fights on both sides of the ticket. I think that means that Democratic voters are very excited here. There's a lot of enthusiasm. They're going to go to the polls on Tuesday.
Let's hope it doesn't snow.
It's not supposed to.
I know.
It's actually cold, but no snow.
Senator, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, turning to other news now, at least 910 people have died as of today from the coronavirus, and at least 40,500 are now infected. The vast majority of infections are in China. All but two of the deaths have occurred there. But Britain today declared the virus an imminent threat to public health, and Chinese President Xi Jinping toured several sites in Beijing wearing a surgical mask. There are now confirmed cases in at least 24 countries, including the U.S., but there are also many people who have recovered from the virus. Joining us now is Dr. Amish Adalja, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's focus on the recovery for a moment. How are doctors treating coronavirus at this point?
There are no specific treatments for coronaviruses. Most of the treatment is going to be supportive, which might mean supplemental oxygen, intravenous fluids for those who are dehydrated, medicines to decrease fever, and medicines to prevent nausea if those symptoms are present. There are some experimental drugs that have been used, and at least one U.S. patient has received an experimental drug, but that's not really part of the routine care of patients yet.
And given that, does it make sense for those who have coronavirus to be quarantined in a hospital, perhaps with other patients who also have coronavirus, or is it better for them to be somewhere else?
We really have to practice medicine, and we know how to decide whether somebody needs to be hospitalized because of a need for medical intervention. So there may be people that have difficulty breathing or need supplemental oxygen or are dehydrated that require hospital admission. But not everybody with coronavirus needs to be hospitalized, and we can treat these patients at home. They can take drugs like Tylenol at home. They can get prescribed anti-nausea medications at home. So we don't want to unnecessarily admit patients. Not only will it burden the hospitals, which often run at high capacity, but also poses an infection control risk, and a lot of other cascading problems can happen. So we really want to stick to validated reasons to admit people to the hospital and try and treat as many people at home as we can.
And no antiviral drugs are being used so far or can be used so far against the coronavirus?
There are no approved or standard antiviral drugs against any coronaviruses. There are some experimental antivirals that are being used. The patient in Washington State did receive an experimental antiviral, and there are efforts to develop clinical trials. But there is no definitive benefit yet from those antivirals. It's an important question that needs to be studied in a systematic, rigorous manner. But there is no pill for the coronavirus or anything that you can give someone to diminish their symptoms as of yet.
One of the problems we've been hearing about is that there's a shortage of testing kits in many places. And in fact, some people who've been diagnosed with the coronavirus have gotten that diagnosis because of a CT scan. What's the best way to find out if somebody's got it?
The best way to find out that someone has a coronavirus is to do the specific coronavirus test. And in the United States, that's a very limited test that initially was restricted to the CDC, but has now been pushed out to the state health department laboratories across the country. CAT scans can give you the nonspecific finding of pneumonia, and there are some people advocating using that in China, but that doesn't give you a specific diagnosis of this coronavirus because there are many causes of pneumonia, and they're only using it in China because they have such a shortage of tests, and they want to have some crude way of telling who is at risk and who isn't at risk.
Doctor, if you were in charge in China right now, especially where there are so many cases, what would you be doing to control this spread of this coronavirus?
Well, the first thing I would do is end the authoritarian measures that have quarantined 60 million people, end the door-to-door knocking on people's doors where they're assessed for symptoms. I would also increase screening of patients with rapid diagnostic test development and really get an understanding of how many cases are out there. Right now, they're only testing severe cases, and that's skewing the data because we're hearing about deaths, but we're not hearing so much about the mild cases that really are the true denominator of this outbreak. And I think that will decrease some of the panic. I would increase the ability of hospitals to care for people that are severely ill, making sure they have proper supply chains and the proper personnel, ensuring personal protective equipment is used appropriately, and trying to develop best practices on how to treat these patients. We've heard about patients getting steroids, for example, which have not been shown to be effective. So there's a lot of effort that can be done to minimize the damage of this outbreak. And a lot of resources are being devoted to enforcing this quarantine that really should be put to better use.
That is Dr. Amish Adalja, who's a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Last Friday, we made our way around downed trees and power lines in a ferocious windstorm in Durham, New Hampshire. To get to a debate watch party at Ray Bell's house.
Hi!
You are terrific. Come on in.
In Ray's cozy den, a handful of friends watched intently.
People are liking the pita chips.
That's Jackie Spinney. She's worked in aviation. She and her husband Tim, a high school guidance counselor, sit next to the coffee table piled with snacks. We brought a debate cake. And we all nibbled on those pita chips as Bernie Sanders was asked if Joe Biden betrayed black voters.
But no. Joe Biden is a friend of mine.
The only thing we should be doing is dealing with terrorism in that region. There's no possibility of uniting that country, no possibility at all of making it a whole country.
But Jackie and neighbor Fred Bramante reacted to Joe Biden on Afghanistan.
I see you nodding.
We agree.
Yeah. He had that position when he ran for president.
Yeah.
He said there's no way to fix Iraq. There's no way to unite this thing.
To have dominion over our own bodies, then it's going to mean we can't simply rely on the courts.
Across the room, Katie Payne, a businesswoman, leaned in and nodded as Elizabeth Warren talked about abortion rights.
It is time to have a national law to protect the right of a woman's choice.
Senator Warren, thank you.
Katie, what do you think?
I think that's brilliant. Yeah, that's what Planned Parenthood's also been saying, is you can't rely on the courts. You have to have laws.
By the way, do you have a candidate?
Probably 90% Elizabeth. I do love Pete Buttigieg, but I decided 3 weeks ago to vote my heart, not my mind. That's who I want to see president.
Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth Warren.
This is not an American issue. It's a global issue.
Interestingly, none of these voters put frontrunner Bernie Sanders at number one, but Tim Spinney listened intently when Sanders spoke of climate change.
See a lot of nodding on this?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's a global issue.
Maybe we pool our resources and fight our common enemy, which is climate change.
Senator Sanders, thank you. George, back to you.
We have much more debate coming up, but we have got to take a break. We'll be right back.
Whoa.
Yeah. Intense.
Okay. So, Tim, catch us up. How's it been?
The debate so far has been great. It's been a really good back and forth between all of them.
What do you need to see tonight?
Just trying to get a sense of where their viewpoints have evolved and where they stand at the moment, given primaries next week. I'm undecided right now, so.
You are undecided?
I am.
It's just a couple days before.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so what do you need to hear? What's missing?
I don't know. I just wanted to see one final sense of where they stand.
Is this the way you usually do it? You just take it up to the end? Or?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people do that.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Again, Tim's wife, Jackie.
I tend to pick my issues. Someone that has military and can do well in foreign affairs, climate, education, whatever the issues are. And then I find someone, I put the puzzle together.
Somebody who's been in the military, and I'm thinking Pete Buttigieg.
Yeah.
Is that who you're thinking?
Yes, definitely.
And is that why? Because he served?
No, because of the other issues that I mentioned and his experience and his composure and his personality also.
Well, it's funny you say experience because the knock on him by his opposition is that he's had one major job out of politics and one in politics, and he was elected by 8,000 people in a small town.
Well, guess what? He was in the military, too, which is a job.
And while we're waiting during the commercials, You haven't mentioned that he's openly gay. Like, that doesn't seem to... That's
well,
like...
it's like having braces to me. It didn't really have anything to do with my decisions. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you worry, though, how important is it for you, for your candidate to beat President Trump? And do you worry that that would be an issue for people who might come over and might not because of that?
I'm aware of it. It's something that we're all aware of, and there is some concern. It's hard in New England or in Boston or in this area because we don't know the Midwest or the South as well as... it's just a natural thing for us, and I don't see it as being a problem. So it's hard for me to picture other people having such a problem with it.
And Fred, what do you think?
I'm a Republican, but I'm open as far as who I'm going to vote for. And I am looking for someone who I think could actually win on the Democratic side. And I see a lot of them that I just don't think it would win. I think that Mike Bloomberg would win. I did hear Tom Steyer say something early on in the debate that, you know, in essence, we're talking about stuff that's not going to matter. That if we're going to win, we have to beat Trump on the economy. And I think that's true.
They're coming back to the debate. But why isn't Trump your candidate?
Generally speaking, I like his policies. I have a hard time with the individual. I'm an educator, and to me, the president ought to be a good role model for our kids, and I think he's the worst.
Well, why don't we? I don't want to interrupt your listening.
Fred was commissioner of education.
Oh,
New Hampshire.
You. So I guess you are an educator, commissioner of education.
I was
chairman
of the state board of education.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
All right. Yeah. We're back. There were some moments that got a rise. Senator Amy Klobuchar was widely thought to have had a good night, but.
At AmyKlobuchar.com.
I hate her.
Hate is such a...
Marketing, that is pandering.
Pandering? It's basically saying, I don't got no money like the rest of you guys.
Then there was Senator Sanders on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal.
Both New Hampshire Senators Maggie Hassan and Senator Jeanne Shaheen supported this. They voted yes, calling it a real win for workers and for farmers. You voted no because you said you believe it takes us back years on climate. Were the senators from New Hampshire wrong?
Yes.
Primary Tuesday.
That just lost him some support.
You attack our senators?
Candidates, thank you. Thanks for being here at St. Anselm College. Thanks for...
Then it was all over. So what did our voters think?
So, Katie, sounds like you're still Elizabeth Warren, maybe Pete a little bit, but Elizabeth Warren. And Fred, you wanted to hear everybody as a Republican, but you're thinking maybe Bloomberg?
There's a bunch of them I like. I like Pete, I like Amy, and I like Andrew Yang. Pete he's the smartest guy up there. You know, I sit there and wonder, will he get clobbered if he runs against Trump, or... is it possible that there will be such a difference on stage, the intelligence, the thoughtfulness of the answers, that he might have a chance? Mm. Amy, I would love to see Amy on the ticket. Andrew Yang makes me think harder. I personally don't like any of their answers on education.
Jackie?
I thought Biden had his best performance and showed a lot of passion. And I was glad, because initially I wanted to like Biden, but I wasn't able to.
So is Biden trumping Pete for you now?
No.
Mayor Pete?
No.
So, Katie, I just heard you say yes.
The thing that worries me most about Biden is this mentality that says, I grew up in a time when things were like this, and I'm going to fix it by doing that just a little bit better. And what Yang does, and the reason I like Yang, is that he says... no, you got to like look at things from a different perspective, because 10 years from now, it's going to be a different world.
I want to ask Tim over here, because you are the undecided.
Yes. I really like this debate because I felt like all of the candidates helped me define the Democratic Party a little bit more. Just that we are a party that supports families, we support kids, we see that climate change is important, that we have all these... values that are important to us that's not happening in this country right now.
And so is somebody emerging?
I thought Amy did a great job tonight. I think when I think about electability, I think Biden. And I do like Andrew Yang. I've been thinking about Yang a lot.
And Ray, our host, you're still with Biden.
Well, I start out the evening committed to Biden, but with doubts. He erased a lot of those doubts tonight. He knows everybody in the world. And this president has destroyed our relationship with virtually every country, and Biden can walk into that to change it. He's an honorable man. I do think that Buttigieg is the brightest star on that stage. I think the fact that he's gay is a big, big problem. As soon as Donald Trump gets ahead of that, what are we going to hear? That makes me fearful. As you've already heard me say, I resent Amy personally because mm-hmm. she steps on everybody's line. Every time she talks about me, it's Amy, I did this, I did that, I can do the other thing.
That's pretty much what we heard from Joe Biden tonight.
Yeah.
I did this, I did that. Do you think it's harder to hear from a woman? I'm just asking.
Well, people have asked me that endlessly. I don't think so. It's hard to say you don't like any of them.
I want to challenge Ray on the gay piece for Pete Buttigieg. Because, first of all, the reason why he got so much money in the first place is because there's a lot of gay people in this country. And I hesitate to say that, you know, Barack Obama, it was unthinkable because he was black. And, you know, so why is Pete unthinkable because he's gay?
Well, you guys have been spectacular. I don't want you to miss the analysis because I know that.
I
probably want to go to bed. Well, no, we have to have cake. We have to have cake. Have some cake.
Yes, we'll cut it.
Our visit to Ray Bell's debate watch party last Friday in Durham, New Hampshire. Thank you, Ray.
Why is it so hard to make new habits? Are pets really that great for us? Why can't I remember where I put my keys? Would you rather be given an award or a bonus? Answers to these questions and more every week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Despite the recent concerns about the economic effects of the coronavirus, the U.S. economy keeps humming along. The Labor Department reported Friday that employers added 225,000 jobs last month, continuing a record-setting run of monthly job growth that has lasted more than 9 years. The unemployment rate ticked up to 3.6%, but remains very low, and stock prices are still near record highs. But that is not the whole story. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So what is the other side of the economic story?
A distinction that you sometimes hear from economists is that there's a difference between rates and levels. And that sounds technical, but it's very, very important. So something like wages, for example, the wages can be growing. The rate can be positive. But a lot of people still might not have enough money to afford basic essentials like medicine, insurance, housing. That is, the level is low. And right now what I see with the economy is that the rate of improvement is really good, is really steady. But because we're coming out of not only a great recession, but also not a great few decades, the level of people's ability to afford essentials is still too low.
And who are those people? Because as we've talked about, many people who voted for President Trump in 2016 felt that they had been left out of the economic recovery after the Great Recession. Who is being left behind since Trump's election?
Let's take two categories. So first, millennials. Wages and stocks are rising. But when the Federal Reserve recently surveyed the economic condition of the millennial generation, that is Americans between, say, 18 and their upper 30s, they summed up millennial circumstances in 7 words: lower earnings, fewer assets, and less wealth. For most Americans, the most important source of their wealth is their home, but homeownership is considerably lower for younger Americans. Among younger Black Americans, homeownership has fallen to a 60-year low. That's millennials. But it's not just young people. Look at white working-class men, who tend to be the bulk of Trump's support. The share of white men in their 40s and 50s who are working today is actually lower than it was in 2007. These are men in their prime working years, and they're less likely to be employed full-time than they were just 13 years ago. So again, the rate of improvement might be high, but we're working from a low level. level.
How unusual is it to have these strong top-level economic indicators at the same time that, as you say, the daily lives of so many Americans seem to be either getting worse or at least not getting better?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there is a simple word for strong top-level indicators that don't reflect the daily lives of many Americans. That word is inequality. If everybody makes the exact same amount of money, the average tells you the whole story. It tells you exactly how much money people are making and how their wages are rising. But if inequality in the population is high, then the average doesn't tell you the whole story at all, because it tells you how the very rich are doing, how the merely rich are doing. But also, it might leave out the fact that the poor are falling behind or starting from a very low level. And that's why I think it's so important in an economy with this level of inequality, the kind of inequality that we've had not just since Trump was elected, not just since Obama was elected, but really that's been growing for the last 30, 35 years, it's always so important to look at the other side of the story.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
We're broadcasting today from NHPR in Concord, New Hampshire, ahead of tomorrow's primary. We're going to talk the polls and where we are in the race in a minute. But first, let's bring in someone well-known to candidates here, Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Laura, I tweeted out, if someone wants to be in politics in the Granite State, they got to go through you to do that. And sitting right next to her, we want to welcome Paul Steinhauser, a Fox News campaign reporter. Paul, welcome. And I'm sorry, as you said when you sat down, I have to sit next to the most popular woman in the state, meaning Laura. Welcome to you as well.
Always an honor and always great to be on Laura's show.
Yeah. Well, for everyone. And Laura, I want to start with you. It feels to us as if this time around, you know, we see you every 4 years, and this time around, there seem to be more undecideds than ever. Let's listen to, we spoke with the Democrat Sue Harth. She works at the Canterbury General Store. We're going to visit there in the program. Still undecided.
I'm not sure who I'm going to vote for.
I'm
kind of leaning towards Amy, but I'm worried that somebody's not going to be able to beat our president. So I hate to say this, but I want to vote for whoever can beat him.
Beat him, meaning President Trump. Amy, meaning Klobuchar, who had a great debate. But it feels like more undecideds.
That may be the case. As of Saturday, a UNH poll, Robin, showed 19% of New Hampshire voters fully undecided, meaning I have no idea, and another 30% leaning toward a candidate, but not necessarily committed. So you do the math, Robin. That's 50% of New Hampshire voters not fully and firmly committed to a candidate. So that does seem like a
right.
lot. You may say, why is that the case?
Right.
It could be because there are so many candidates this time, so you have so many choices as a Democratic voter. That being said, Robin, it's worth noting that New Hampshire voters are notoriously late deciders. But I do agree with you.
Yeah.
This is a big undecided vote.
And then independents, which there's a huge number, 42% of the voters are independent. And they can vote.
They can vote. And they're often described as a wild card. Now, just to be clear, scholarship by the wonderful poli-sci team at UNH says only about 10 to 15% of New Hampshire voters are truly independent or undeclared. That's the official term we use for them. In general, these people are pretty much reliable Republicans or reliable Democrats. That being said, you're absolutely right, Robin. Independents or undeclareds can vote in either primary, and most independents will probably go where the action is, which is on the Democratic side.
Well, speaking of where the action is, I mean, last week we came off this tumultuous week. We had the impeachment trial, which ended with President Trump being cleared, not indicted, not convicted, rather. We had his State of the Union address with the hard feelings that came out of that. We then had the prayer breakfast and then his speech, which was a celebration of his being cleared in the trial, and Iowa, you know, and all this. So Paul Steinhauser, Where are we now? Because the whole race has been thrown up in the air.
This is crazy. This may be the first time we get the first official results from New Hampshire before Iowa, but we all saw the reporting debacle out there. And even when the final results were in Iowa, we really don't have a clear victor. Both Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg claiming victory. It seems that Pete Buttigieg has the slightest of leads when it comes to the delegate metric. But with the raw popular vote, Bernie Sanders is ahead. So Iowa did not really help us. We've got a jumbled race. And here it's pretty clear that the latest polling indicates that Sanders, who comes obviously from next door in Vermont and is very well known here, was the big winner 4 years ago over Hillary Clinton, He's got the lead in the latest polls with Buttigieg second. It really seems like a battle for third place right now between the former Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Elizabeth Warren, our neighbor to the south in Massachusetts, and Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, getting a bump out of Friday night's debate, Robin. Right.
I'm hearing that I didn't get to see any of them, but I'm hearing that some of her events, Laura, she's getting like 1,000 people.
Well, Klobuchar did get a bump after that debate for sure. Paul's absolutely right. The Boston Globe poll showed her moving up 3 percentage points just over the weekend. And then we had a show this morning, Robin, on The Exchange, just checking in with listeners, how they were feeling. And we heard from tons of people who were converted to Amy Klobuchar over the weekend. So it does seem like we're experiencing a Klobuchar surge here in New Hampshire. How big it is, I won't predict.
Right. How big is the battle right now between Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden? We know that Joe Biden came out with that ad campaign. If people haven't seen it, pretty much it contrasts the big things that he did with President Obama, you know, passing health care. And then the ad pivots to, you know, and Mayor Buttigieg in South Bend got lights on a bridge overpass so that there could be pretty lights on the water, or helped people with their pets. I think he should have said it's very important to help people with their pets. But here's how he responded on, I think it was CBS Face the Nation. Here's how he responded to that positioning of him as sort of a small person, small town mayor. Let's listen.
Maybe my community does look good, does look small from the perspective of Washington. But to us, a lot of times it's the infighting in the Washington establishment that looks small. And the work that we're doing on the ground in communities that are tired of being treated as a Washington punchline.
Well, Paul, how's he handling this?
He's pushing back quite effectively. He used that line on the campaign trail as well this week, and I was with him. And he's also getting some very, very large crowds. In fact, he broke the record for Democrats this cycle with over 1,800 on Sunday. Then a few hours later, Bernie Sanders topped him with 1,900. Those are pretty large crowds for here in New Hampshire. But no, Buttigieg got a lot of momentum, got a big bump out of Iowa. Now, though, he has to meet the higher expectations, because in politics, it's all about meeting expectations. His are much higher now.
And this is somewhat the tug of war in the party right now, Laura. I mean, it's not just over health care for all versus let's go slow, you know, progressives versus moderates. There's a generational tug.
There is a generational tug, and it's interesting watching the debates. The early debates were all about the wonky details of Medicare for All and whose tax plan and how candidates would deal with NATO. This last debate we saw, Robin, and all the speeches we heard in the state over the weekend were all about this sort of, like you said, a generational message. And who are we as a party? Are we in that more progressive wing of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren? Are we going to try to build the coalitions that Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar promised that they will build? So it's really interesting to see this going on.
Yeah.
It's the idea of, I mean, you see this often, but this is really an ideological debate.
Well, and they're, you know, Buttigieg said the other night, turn the page. We want to turn the page. I want to skip ahead to Elizabeth Warren. She was the target for a while because she was so far ahead. She's had some slipping. We want to listen to her at a campaign event in Manchester.
The only way we're going to make this better is we use this Democratic primary to build a grassroots movement, that's there for the primary, there for the general, and there to make real change in 2021.
Putting her heart out there. But, Paul, what do you think happened here? I mean, she has slipped. What's happened?
She started slipping in October when she had to explain, A, she was getting more scrutiny because she was jumping in the polls, but also more scrutiny over her came her way. And a lot of progressives didn't like her answers on Medicare for All, how she was going to pay for it and how she was going to roll it in. And yeah, she's definitely seen some slippage. This is an important contest for her. It's in her backyard. It's not going to knock her out if she has a poor finish, but it's not going to help one bit. She's got a strong ground game here. She's got one of the best organizations in the state, and she's hoping it brings her voters out. But also Joe Biden, same thing. You know, another poor finish here, and those firewalls in South Carolina are going to start to burn down.
And Laura, you know the knock on New Hampshire, which is that I think the number of African Americans in the state has slipped to 1%. And that's why the Democratic Party maybe added, states like South Carolina, Nevada. But can Joe Biden really say that this doesn't matter if he doesn't do well here?
You know, it's a good question. And I think former Vice President Biden needs to do reasonably well here in New Hampshire, or it could look difficult for him. His statement in the debate right off the bat, Robin, that I took a hit in Iowa and I expect to take a hit in New Hampshire, was disheartening for his supporters who were ready to spend the weekend like all the other supporters of all the other campaigns, you know, out in the snow, knocking on doors and so forth. And so it was disheartening for them to hear him say that, even if he is trying to play the expectations game, which candidates often do.
Is there something, Paul, that you'll be looking for? We've got a minute left. Something you'll be looking for tomorrow that will be a tea leaf for you?
With turnout, obviously, the higher the turnout, the more it can help us. Somebody like a Bernie Sanders or a Pete Buttigieg, a lower turnout may help actually a Joe Biden. But that is one of the key things. And remember, the turnout in Iowa was not a record at all. It didn't even come close to the 2008 record. Are Democrats really energized to get out there and get Donald Trump out of the White House? Turnout here will be very telling.
That's Paul Steinhauser, Fox News 2020 campaign reporter. We also have been speaking to Laura Kanoy, host of The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. And Laura, I want to show you, I've just unbuttoned my sweater. I wore this T-shirt just for you. It says,
what does it say?
Didn't I interview you 4 years ago? I wear it all over town. Thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
And the Oscar goes to Parasite.
A surprise at the Oscars last night when the South Korean film Parasite became the first foreign language film ever to win Best Picture. It also won for Best International Feature Film. Writer-director Bong Joon-ho also won for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay. Joining me now from Pasadena, California, is John Horn of KPCC's The Frame. Hi, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
And you thought that he would win Best Director, but you thought 1917, as many did, would win Best Picture. How big of a surprise was it that it won, and what's the message that sends?
First of all, you obviously saw my ballot for the KPCC office pool. That's exactly what I picked. But what it represents in terms of the Academy and its demographics, I think is a much more important story. Only one of the 20 acting nominees was a person of color. That was Cynthia Erivo from Harriet. And the Academy has really struggled to diversify its membership. But most recently, it's really pushed to have people from outside the United States. The Hollywood Reporter did a study that found in the last 4 years, 39% of the new members of the Academy are outside of the United States. And I think that really reflects not only their interest in films like Parasite, but also that the Academy itself as an organization is willing to take a risk on a movie that is a little bit tough to watch, a little bit gritty, certainly shocking at the end, and not a traditional movie like 1917. So it's a historical moment for the Academy in terms of foreign language, but I think it really represents a sea change in the membership.
Well, and I have to say I was so happy that I decided to watch it on Friday night so I could see it before the Oscars. It was fantastic. You forget that you're watching a film with subtitles after a while because you get drawn so much into it. But it's a class story about the haves and the have-nots in Korea. And I want you to stand by for a minute, John, because we're also joined now by Kyung Kim, who's a professor of East Asian Studies at UC Irvine. Professor Kim, how big of a deal is this for South Korean Americans like you as you watched the Oscars last night?
Well, it's not just a great moment for Korean Americans, but also Koreans. I've been following the news over in South Korea just over the last 12 hours or so, and they're just exploding. I think recognize that, listen, not only do we make K-pop, but we're actually capable of doing something serious, dramatic as a Parasite was.
Well, and this was obviously the first foreign language film ever to win Best Picture, but also, I believe, the first Korean film ever to get nominated in the foreign language film category.
Yeah, so it's been a minor cinema until this point. I mean, it's been overshadowed by Japanese and Chinese cinema from the same region over the last, 100 years. Mm-hmm. And to have this now, I can be a little bit more, confident when I actually program or, teach Korean cinema.
You think that there are other Korean directors and movie makers watching that and getting some new confidence or inspiration in their work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely. I mean, Bong Joon-ho has given confidence over the years, even before Parasite. He was the first director who actually was financed, fully by American studios. And his films have really been just monumental in every detail. throughout his career over the last 20, 25 years. So they knew somehow that there was, you know, this inspiration out there. They didn't know, I mean, including myself, we didn't know that he was going to seize this Best Picture prize at Academy Awards. I mean, this was a shock.
Well, John Horn, back to you in Pasadena. Does this at least help Oscars take away the Oscars so white hashtag, because they did give the Best Picture award to a Korean film?
I think it certainly does help. I mean, I think it's an important turn for the Academy. Obviously, the most important question is, does it last a year? Does it last 2 years? But also beyond like what Parasite means in terms of foreign language, I think it's also important to look at what it means in terms of the kinds of movies that the Academy recognizes for Best Picture. You can argue about Green Book's merits, Shape of Water the year before that, Moonlight, Spotlight.
Right.
The Academy is recognizing movies about disenfranchised people, people who have been marginalized based on the color of their skin, their sexual orientation, their class. And I think Parasite, in a way, fits into the recent model of the movies that the Academy thinks are worth lifting up. And I think that's almost as critical a part of this story as it is that Bong Joon-ho won 4 Oscars. The guy won 4 Oscars. I mean, that's unbelievable.
How do you
One
even
guy
leave the theater
four
with all
Oscars,
of those? Right.
And yeah, he never even, he just like, by the fourth time he went up on stage, I was sitting in the audience saying, what else does he have to say now?
Do you get to put him in a locker or something when you have to keep going back up, I wonder?
He might have a little, like one of those rolling duffel bags to carry him home with, because they're very heavy. But still, this film represents this idea that the Academy is singling out movies about people who have been marginalized and disenfranchised, and that's almost as important as the first foreign language Best Picture winner.
That is John Horn, host of The Frame on KPCC, and we've also been speaking with Kyung Kim, a professor at UC Irvine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And my advice, if you have not seen the film, is to make sure you see Parasite, because it was really terrific. Yes. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
A New Hampshire shelter for pregnant women with addiction will meet one mother who's gaining strength from her toddler son.
I get this feeling looking at him and knowing how perfect he is, but I also know that my disease is stronger than that. Like, I have to rely on God. I have to rely on the women in the program.
Also, the latest from the primary, next time, Here and Now.